Good morning. Chris Aberle, court-appointed counsel for Ronald Wilkerson, who in the district court raised a Batson claim after the government used five of its six peremptory strikes against to remove African-American jurors from the mostly white jury veneer. And given the deference that the United States has and should have in exercising its peremptory strikes, and given the concomitantly high burden that a defendant faces in establishing a Batson challenge, we have limited our challenge to focusing on one particular juror, Lucinda Carney, though we do so mindful of a rather disproportionate pattern of peremptory strikes targeted at African Americans. As the U.S. Supreme Court said in Miller L1, happenstance is unlikely to produce this disparity. Now, our position, as we argued below, is that the asserted reason for dismissing Ms. Carney was inherently implausible and demonstrably false. And for purposes of oral argument, our position is well illustrated by starting with what the government has argued in its brief.
Mr. Everly, yeah. Maybe it'd help you a little bit if I just share with you a concern I have. You make a very strong case that we tend to persuade looking at it on paper, if I were there, the trial judge, I might have done something differently. But my concern is the extraordinary deference that, for your case, my concern is the strong deference that we give to district judges. They see the veneer, they see the reactions of the people to questions, all the things that lawyers and judges rely upon in jury selection routinely. And here we are down in New Orleans sort of looking at paper. That's my concern, is how do you surmount that heavy burden that's placed on you?
Well, as I believe you yourself said in Williamson, review is not a hallow act. And what we have in this case are some of your classic indicators that we rely on to conclude that a district court has committed clear error in making its determination. And we believe there's four of those in this case. Let's see if I come up with four. But the first one is just the government's position is that because Ms. Carney was silent in response to those general voir dire questions, questions designed basically to determine whether a juror is not qualified to serve, that therefore they don't know enough about her.
Well, I got the sense the government sort of slid off of that one, though, as justification.
I'm sorry?
I said I thought the government sort of slid away from that.
Slid away from it?
Yeah, so that.
Well, then there's not. Well, that one obviously we
on
have.
On appeal, they did.
And on appeal. Well, on appeal, this is where I was going to start. They say that they gave three reasons. The first one was this non-responsiveness. The second one was inattentiveness. And the third was that she was sleeping. And the government states in its brief, and I'm going to quote, as the district court found, these were legitimate and race-neutral reasons for the peremptory strike. But that is not correct. With respect to two of these asserted claims, the district court most certainly did not find that these were race-neutral, legitimate grounds.
Where was this case being tried?
I'm sorry?
Where was this case being tried?
Baton Rouge?
In Baton Rouge.
The claim about inattentiveness. That we believe, I think we've argued well enough, and if not, just I'm willing to give more argument, that argument about the microphone and about the other juror who knew her is just indefensible. But more important, that wasn't made below, so the district court did not and could not possibly have rendered a decision based on this inattentiveness. Now, sleeping, they did raise sleeping as an argument, but it's important here to note as well that the district court did not rely on sleeping when it issued its ruling.
I thought sleeping was off the table, too. They conceded that because of the glasses, it wasn't sure that where they're sleeping around.
Well, our position is that they themselves, yes, took it off the table, and that was after, you know, making a rather belated assertion about glasses. But of course, you know, they do raise it on appeal, and our point is that the district court didn't rule on it. Then this court doesn't need to consider it. In fact, the government filed a 28J letter on Friday citing U.S. versus Thompson, and that case does not help them. It, on the other hand, it does emphasize that the holding, at least the consensual holding of Snyder versus Louisiana, is that if the district, if the government makes a demeanor-based argument and another argument, and the district court does not make a finding on the demeanor-based argument, and even more important, makes an affirmative finding, as in this case, on the other argument, then this court doesn't need doesn't consider the demeanor-based.
Well, why didn't the district judge here implicitly determine credibility by what it did rule? I mean, he didn't articulate his ruling in terms of credibility of the counsel, but his statement of the reasons themselves arguably implicitly accept those.
I'm not sure that would be the case. Well, first of all, in Snyder, the same argument in Snyder was, you know, that argument was rejected because, you know, the court implicitly, you certainly could argue implicitly accepted the demeanor-based argument, but you didn't know because there was two different arguments made in that case. Here in this case, the district court says, mind you, it's not completely unambiguous, but in the case of Ms. Carney, the government has articulated its reasons, and specifically it cites the defendant's age, which we don't really know what that means because age of the defendant or of Ms. Carney was never, as the government concedes, an asserted ground. But then the court says, and the fact that she did not appear, at least to the government, to be responsive to all the questions that were asked. That was their primary, their first and their last argument, was that she did not answer questions that were posed to her or posed generally to the voir dire.
Well, let me ask you about the whole context for that. My understanding is there were no jury questionnaires or other information available to the counsel about the members of the venari. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So I have not looked at the list of questions. I've heard the number. You may have just used it, 50, 55 questions. I assume a fair number of those were offered by counsel on both sides on things they wanted to be ferreted out of the venari members?
Yes. They were asked by the district court judge.
Verbally articulated, but presented or offered by counsel on both sides, or are they just standard questions that Judge Jackson uses?
They were proposed jury questions from both sides. Now, how they ended up and, which ones were accepted and in what process that was undertaken is not clear to me from the record, and I wasn't trial counsel.
It seems to me that if offered by counsel, among the things they have been pursuing is a connection to the facts in one way or the other of the case. Have you been affected by a crime like this before? Do you use a tax preparer? I'm not sure what else they would have asked.
Right.
It seems to me part of what the government was saying about non-responsive, and you address it to some extent in the brief. Let me start with what you say in your brief, which is it looked to you as if the government was trying to find someone who would be sympathetic to their case, which I feel like saying shocked, surprised that that's what they would be looking for. And so when they say that no answers came from her, that was an indication that she didn't have any connection helpful to the government in her life experience to what would be presented in court. Is that a Brady problem? I mean, a Batson problem?
It is in this case.
Well, in this case, because you say it was a pretext for racial discrimination, but I'm just saying generally, if you're looking for somebody who would have some familiarity with this, who would be concerned about what tax preparers do, who would understand what tax preparers do, is that a legitimate inquiry? And to have no answer from a venari member, is that not a legitimate concern?
It's a race-neutral reason, for sure. I don't know that you get very far in this case because As to those questions, there were actually several jurors, and I don't, not just the two or three I mentioned, but several jurors who didn't have answers to those questions.
Was that raised in the district court? That's one of the things government says, that these comparators and relying on Supreme Court authority, if raised for the first time on appeal, are not very convincing. Were these names, Shoemaker and whoever the other one was, Sellers, presented to Judge Jackson in the district court?
They were not.
Mm-hmm.
But
proceed. I'm not saying they're irrelevant. So what about those comparators?
Well, and of course, it is often the case where they're not. Snyder itself, Miller L., those comparators were not raised in the district court. The idea is that if you don't do so, you have it's a little harder to evaluate them. But here we have a unique situation where the issue isn't what was the answers they gave and how do you compare these different answers. What we're comparing is the fact that no answers were given. As the government says, Ms. Carney spoke 22 words during voir dire. In fact, it was 25, and that's even counting contractions as one word. But Ms. Sellers spoke 17 words.
Here, do we have a 28J on how many words? No, that's all right, that there were.
And
not many words, we can agree. Are you saying that either Sellers or whoever the person was, similarly was silent?
Yes, Earl Brown and Jill Sellers answered exactly the same questions that she did about her job and her age and her race, etc., and did not answer exactly the same questions that she didn't answer. So they know nothing more.
Well, to me, the distinction, and a powerful distinction in your favor, is that these are not questions directed specifically to a member of the binary. They're global questions. If anybody does, you raise your hand.
Correct.
That kind of routine. And so I don't know, frankly, I don't attribute much significance to the fact that we don't know whether there was anything she didn't know. The fact is, when she was addressed directly, as I understand the record, she responded directly and cogently and without hesitation. So I guess I'm
correct.
A little trouble with that.
In other words, they didn't ask questions like, is anyone here smart enough to be on this jury? Or is anyone here can be fair and impartial? Obviously, failure to answer those questions would be significant.
Well, it's very common. You get in a binary to ask the general questions that a good percentage of the jurors will never respond to any of them because they don't pertain to them. I frankly don't understand that argument of the government.
And the government may have the better view, where in the record are the questions that were being asked to see what kinds of responses might have been relevant? Is there just a transcript of the voir dire?
It's all in the transcript of the voir dire. The questions are not set out separately in this record, and the voir dire is 600 pages, I think. So they're in there, but all it takes a while to find them. Anyway, we conclude that the juror comparison, the fact that they didn't inquire, they had a concern about her not knowing, about them not knowing about her, and yet they don't ask her any questions, and the fact that we already have a prima facie disproportionate use of peremptory strikes, and the fact that the whole concern about not knowing about her raises the assumption that maybe she doesn't have a life experience, which raises the assumption that she doesn't have might not have the intellectual capacity to understand this case is, we believe, based on dubious inferences and is of questionable logic.
Thank you. If we could pause for just a minute, you can have a seat. Is our lighting system going to work here, or is it working? We need to get Judge Jolly back on the phone.
Do I have to start over?
It's being recorded, so one level of technology may supplement the other.
Judge Jolly's chambers.
Robert Collins from the en banc courtroom for Judge Jolly.
Hold, please.
This is Judge Jolly's chambers.
Okay, y'all are go.
Hello?
Alice?
I can hardly hear you.
Okay.
I've got Judge Jolly's volume all the way up, but can't hear you.
How about now?
No. Robert.
Is this any better? Alice?
Robert?
Alice?
Okay. All right, we're on now.
Okay.
Can you hear us, Alice?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to step off the bench.
We'll now hear from the government. And just to be clear to defense counsel, whatever Judge Jolly didn't hear is recorded and will be available. Please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Shubha Shivpuri, and I represent the United States in this case. Just as an initial note, I was not trial counsel on this case. However, I am arguing on behalf of the United States.
Well, let me ask you a question. Yeah, you can slice and dice this in legalistic terms, but if you back away and look at this thing, you had what happened here is that the first jump by the government was a challenge for cause. Two black members got one for cause, the other one was overruled. And then they exercised their peremptories and struck 5 out of 6 persons, all that were black. Now, you know, if I just stop there, unless you got some very good explanations, that tells me something. I mean, common sense tells you that something's going on here, and I don't see what the explanations are. So that I tell you at the outset that's what concerned me. Now we all address this, and well, we shift this burden of proof, and then we have the side by side comparisons. None of those that the government comes up with make a whole lot of sense.
Understood, Your Honor.
So what is the explanation for why you struck these people?
Well, I would, as an initial note, just like to point you on, you bring up the 5 of the 6 being used against African-American jurors.
Is that the number?
That is the number. There were 48 members of the veneer in this case, 13 of which were African-American. That's approximately 27%.
How many peremptory challenges does the government have?
6. If you look at the eventual panel, that was of 12.
Well, they made 2 challenges for cause, and right, and they exercised 6 peremptories. Only one of those was addressed toward a Caucasian. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. However, we would submit that the reasons that we, the kind of jury that we were trying to get in this case would be a jury that we thought would be able to give the government a fair shake in this trial and be able to listen to the evidence that the government would present. We would submit that it would be incidental that they were African-American, not because they were African-American.
But what Batson is directed as is you don't index fairness by the color of the man's skin.
Absolutely.
So you've got to give me some other reasons other than, first you said, well, one of the black jurors was sleeping. You backed off of that because you said you couldn't tell. Right?
Well, we can take it one by one.
You said they didn't answer questions. Well, they were global questions. And three other persons you never even asked supplementary questions to didn't answer the question. They did the same thing. They didn't respond to the global questions either. They weren't pertaining to them. Does any member of the veneer here know any lawyer on the other side? Do they know anything about the facts of this case? All those kinds of questions that judges ask to qualify juries.
Absolutely. With regard to Ms. Carney, That is absolutely the case. If you don't have a question that pertains to you, then you don't. There's no reason why you would have to answer it. I think the reason why it was relevant.
Why did you strike those white members of the jury that didn't answer the questions either? Never told you anything.
The trouble with that analysis, Your Honor, is that there are intangibles that occur during jury selection.
There,
there are intangibles, right? During jury selection, it's 48 people coming in, if I could transport you back, to jury selection, and there it's a hodgepodge of the community, 27% African-American, the rest white, and you have a limited number of questions that the district court, that each side proposes jury questions, the district court asks them questions. So a lot of it is being in the courtroom, observing the jurors, and so That's why it's very difficult.
I spent most of my lifetime in the courtroom, you know, 53 years of it, and about 600 of them trials. And so I'm not a stranger to the picking juries as a lawyer or, and neither is my counsel nor Judge Jolly either. When we were all a little younger, at least Judge Jolly and I were a little younger. So, I mean, I don't mean to be difficult with you, but I'm just telling you that what my reaction to it, in all honesty, is that I see this, it troubles me what happened in this case. And so I'm looking for explanations. And I want to be honest with you about it. Could give me those explanations. And so far, I just don't hear anything.
Your Honor, if you look at pages 794 to 797 of the record, trial counsel, and I absolutely can agree with Your Honor that perhaps it was not, semantically not the most articulate way of responding and saying that the juror was non-responsive. I think what was meant by the term non-responsive was there just really isn't much to go by with this juror. It was a combination of the fact that she did not seem interested, and when trial counsel was able to elaborate on what she meant by non-responsiveness, clearly the district court wanted to hear more from both the prosecutor and the defendant in this case. And so on those particular pages of the record, you have trial counsel being able to explain a little bit more about what she meant by non-responsive. It wasn't simply that, okay, well, she just didn't have answers to questions. Because she didn't have answers to questions, we didn't see her engaging. She appeared to be falling asleep. And you better than anyone knows from your trial experience that not everybody has the same perception. So when things are dynamic and fluid, you confer with co-counsel. Well, actually, I think you saw her sleeping.
You go back to falling asleep, but then I read the briefs, and I thought that you virtually conceded that they couldn't tell whether she's sleeping or not.
Well, there
is.
There's case law in the Fifth Circuit where even if trial counsel proffers a reason that she thought somebody appeared to fall asleep, that was sufficient as race neutral.
I understand that distinction. It is the question of what was the question is whether or not they struck because of race. If they erroneously thought they were asleep, that's still a non-racial reason. I understand that distinction, but my question is whether they did she think that the juror was asleep or not?
Yes, Your Honor. She thought the juror was asleep. When the Batson challenge was made, I think she thought...
And what about the other five? Were they sleeping too?
No, Your Honor, but she didn't proffer that they were sleeping to the district court either. And in regards to the other one, which are not in dispute here, one was an attorney who we asked to strike for cause to begin with because we thought that she might have undue influence on the jury. And Your Honor well knows that that's sort of a routine explanation, and the district court acknowledged that.
All right, that's
and then in regards to another one of his, he openly stated to the district court that one of his cousins dated the defendant 20 years prior, and we'd rather not serve. His words to the court was that he would rather not serve. So he was, we struck him. So these are race neutral reasons why I know that five out of six.
Well, that's two.
So let's go through the other ones. We have Sharika Nelson, who was a staff attorney. We have Jada Stanley, who, The United States proffered that she was inattentive. She was looking at the defendant very frequently, which, again, when you're looking at jurors and trying to glean information from them, she appeared to have some kind of affinity for him and was not paying attention during voir dire, which the district court found to be credible. We have Frederick Brown, who is the who is the one whose cousins dated the defendant. So those are Frederick Brown, Lucinda Carney, Jada Stanley, Sharika Nelson. We have Christy Hicks, who the district court was going to actually excuse for cause, or rather just excuse because she had an anniversary coming up and had a trip planned. So he was concerned that she wouldn't be attentive during a two-week tax fraud money laundering case, when her mind would be on vacation.
What was the race of the defendant?
The race of the defendant?
Yes.
African-American. And then the sixth one was the white male. But as this court has, and I'm sure Your Honor well knows, has held recently in United States versus Pratt, where the United States used five of their six peremptory challenges to strike African-American jurors, and only one was eventually paneled, as opposed to this case where three were impaneled. So three African-Americans, 25% of the eventual jury was African-American. So this was not a systematic attempt.
Well, you only had six peremptories.
Sorry. Yes, we did. But the reason we exercised these peremptories was absolutely not because of their race. And in United States versus Thompson, five of seven peremptories were used against African-American jurors. So while absolutely relevant, Your Honor, it's not dispositive on its own that these are pretextual reasons.
Counsel, can you get into the specific questions that were asked to help me understand why it would be relevant if someone was non-responsive, if there are questions about, do you know the attorneys, do you know the defendant, that sort of thing? They need to be non-responsive to be on the jury. What kinds of questions, what specific paraphrased questions were asked if you were born into the transcript enough, were asked that would be relevant in this inquiry?
Sure, Your Honor. The types of questions that were asked, in addition to do you know the defendant, do you know the counsel, were things like, have you had any interactions with the IRS, negatively or positively, any kind of audit issues, any kind of issues with filing your taxes, have you ever used a tax preparer, have you ever been a victim of identity theft or any kind of financial crime? Then there's some more general questions. Are you related to or have any close friends in law enforcement? Do you have any relatives or friends who work for the government, city, state, federal? What is your employment experience? Have you ever had a supervisory position at work? If so, what kinds of supervisory positions do you have? What kind of bumper stickers or decals do you have on your car? Or anything that you have, and then
would a good answer to the bumper sticker question have been?
For good answer for the United States or good answer for the defendant?
You're looking for, I guess, law enforcement, conservative viewpoints.
Well, for example, sorry to interrupt, Your Honor, but one of them had a U.S. Marine Corps. It's just sort of just another piece of information that we can glean from an individual, because as you both well know, there's very limited things that you're working off with. So you're just trying to get a picture of what kind of juror they would be, and particularly.
Is there anything in this record that would show what white jurors that were actually selected also? My sense of it is only these two new comparators would be relevant. Is it clear that the six or seven, whatever it would be, however many white jurors there were on the Venari, did answer some of these questions, or do we know that?
Yes, Your Honor. If we look at the eventual, the three African-Americans who made it onto the jury, juror number three was Brian Stewart, 52-year-old black male, worked for Shell Motiva for 27 years, clearly technical position there, had a credit card stolen at some point, served on a federal grand jury as the deputy foreperson, served on civil juries in Ascension Parish, involved in a personal injury lawsuit himself. His wife worked for the Ascension Parish School Board. We have juror number 11, Ms. Jenkins, 28-year-old black female. She was studying business management. Also, she works as an administrative coordinator as well as being a full-time student. Her mother was the victim.
Let me ask you a question about the procedures that this particular court used. The Venari summoned randomly, mathematically random way, and are they seated in the courtroom in that fashion?
I believe so, Your Honor. I believe it is a random.
And you have a strike list. correct?
That is correct.
And ordinarily what you're going to do when you got six strikes, they got six strikes, so you know that the bottom 24 are not going to be reached, so you get your cut line and then you work down, strike down, correct?
That is correct.
Oh, okay, now stay with me. In fact, do you have the strike list in the record?
I do not believe that the strike list is in the record. Those are notes that we keep.
What I was trying to understand was the racial makeup in the sequence in which the jurors are selected. You take the first. Did you see a 12-person jury or in this case or an alternate or something? How many jurors were seated at a jury?
There were 12 impaneled, and then there were three alternates.
All right. So the practice then that once the strike list are turned in, you take the first 12 that remain?
Yes.
And what's the racial makeup in the sequence of that panel, do you know?
I don't know what the racial makeup was, but if we can extrapolate from what we've had. The first thing that I would like to note, though, is the voir dire was slightly off in this case because there were two trials going on at the same time. So there weren't enough jury members when we first started. So there was like half of the panel who came in first, and then the rest kind of joined in.
I understand, but
if we were to take...
Those are actually technically panels. The voir dire is that is randomly selected as the entire group that's brought to the court from which are cut panels to go to the court.
Okay, I'm sorry, I misunderstood you.
So I'm just trying to get a sense of how the mechanics of how this operated.
Sure, Your Honor. If there were 13, well, just extrapolating, I can't say for sure, but say there were 13 members of the voir dire who were African American. Well, we know that at least three were impaneled, so there's those three, and then there were the five that the government struck, so there were at least those five, that's eight, and then there were those who were...
Do we know if they were where they were on the list?
Yes, so the last one who made it onto the jury was juror number 20, and the ones who were struck... were juror number 22, juror number 14, juror number 13 was Ms. Carney, juror number 12 was Ms. Stanley, and juror number 2 was Ms. Nelson.
Oh, yes. So the five of the six were struck were in the first 12?
Two that were struck were in the first 12.
I'm sorry?
Two of them were in the first 12, juror number 2 and juror number 12. Ms. Carney wasn't until juror number 13.
I just wonder how many were in the first 15 of the Venari panel. How many of your strikes were exercised of the black members in the first 14 of the Venari panel?
That would be juror number 2, number 12, number 13, and number 14.
I'm sorry?
Four. Your Honor. But again, we would submit that those, we had race neutral reasons for all of those. In regards to the comparators, we would argue that like Your Honor absolutely identified, this is a cold appellate record. And so they're very limited. We can't make a demeanor based distinction, which would be important to make. Ms. Sellers was a dental assistant, which, from the limited information we have, would imply to us that she had some kind of technical...
Let me ask you one more question that bothered me that I didn't understand. The argument was made by trial counsel, the observation was made that the strike that we're focused on here was made in part because that particular Girard simply had no life except going to work and coming back. And as I recall it, and my question is, she also answered no other questions other than the ones that were directly put to her. What was the basis of that conclusion and observation by trial counsel?
The basis of the observation, and again, I would direct you to those few pages where she was able to elaborate on that phrase, lack of life experience. I think it is an unfortunate phrase. I think what she meant to say is...
Well, I don't know what she meant to say. Just what did she say?
She said that, if looking at that page... I can't seem to pull that up, but what she meant to say, what she said was she did not engage with the court. I would assume because she said that she was a janitor.
Ruth said, as I recall it, that she doesn't have a life, that she just goes to work every day and has not engaged in anything else.
From what we could, from the questions that were put in regards to whether she wasn't a supervisor, she didn't have... any contact with law enforcement. She wasn't a victim of a crime.
What do you mean she didn't have any contact with law enforcement?
That is what was said. By contact with law enforcement means hasn't had any kind of relatives who've had, she hasn't had any interaction with the criminal justice system that we were able to glean from some of the other jurors. For example, they had been a victim of a crime, or a relative of theirs had been a victim of a crime, or they had relatives who were either defense attorneys or lawyers or things such that they would be in contact with the criminal justice system. She didn't have any of that.
You had two white persons that did not answer any of those questions either.
That's right, Your Honor, but maybe that white juror was paying attention the whole time. Maybe that white juror, the white juror had a job that required her as a dental assistant to have some kind of technical expertise where there would be some attention to detail. And at this point, we're grasping at little things because that's what we have to work with. And this was a 2-week tax fraud case where there were, you know, the indictment itself took about 15 pages to read. That was of paramount concern to us. Will this person, if they're not interested in voir dire, as counsel said on page, I think, 797, if they can't engage in voir dire, we have questions of whether they would engage or be interested in the deliberation process.
All right, counsel. We have your argument. Thank you.
I was just going to point out, we're in the record, that she was looking for. I've submitted to the court that she was non-responsive. She did not engage with the court. She did not have any response whatsoever to more than 60 questions. I made an assumption that perhaps she didn't have much of a life outside of work. And I think that's the bottom line of their argument. And, you know, Ms. Sellers was a dental assistant. I'm not sure what you get from that, but Mr. Brown worked for the Department of Transportation for 44 years. Doing what? We know he wasn't the CEO because he didn't volunteer that he was a supervisor, but what do they know about him? Nothing. They know nothing more about him than they know about Ms. Carney. He could have laid cones out for 44 years. They're grasping because they need to. As far as just the sleeping thing.
Do you think Judge Jackson may have indirectly accepted that as an argument? His first statement was that the government had argued that an age issue. I wonder if that was a label for sleeping on the job. At least seems to be a possible way that Judge Jackson was referring to the argument that she was sleeping. You're reading tea leaves if you answer that.
I don't know.
It does seem to me that may have been what Judge Jackson meant.
I don't think so. Well, she's 51. She's
a very young age.
Yes. Earl Brown was 65. And also, you know, the court seemed to be, you know, the court was thinking of several jurors at the time. As you notice, the court refers to Ms. Carney as Ms. Stanley after that. And it's not clear whether he really means Ms. Stanley or Ms. Carney. He may have been confusing a different strike. I'm not sure, but it is a mystery, and the government concedes that it's not clear why the court came up with that age thing. And he said the defendant's age. He didn't say the juror's age. So you know, that makes it even more mysterious. And just about being asleep, it said, now whether or not she was asleep, I don't know. It could be because of the glare from her glasses. What does that mean? Because you couldn't see her eyeballs, maybe they were closed. You know, it's rather ambiguous. And being belated a claim as it was, Miller L. says, as Miller L. said, number two, it reeks of afterthought. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The court notes that you are court appointed, indispensable to our hearing.